for July 1st, 2020. I'm Steve Boder.
And I'm Action Adventure Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
No. You are Canada Day, Pam Bedore. Happy Canada Day to all of our Canadian friends.
That's right. You know what? It's a great day to go out and have a barbecue and celebrate. And then for all the Americans, we can go and we can try to learn the Canadian history. Or go through Canada trivia and recognize how little we know.
And you guys, have a poutine. We
watched a show yesterday where they were making poutine, and my wife got so excited, and then they put oysters on it. She went, nope, and she walked out of the room.
No.
Those are aphrodisiacs, Steve. Oysters.
Oh, and that's our segue to Chapter 10, The End Islander. Because don't forget that we ended our last chapter with Holmes serving oysters.
Mm-hmm. He did.
Now, in case you were wondering, at the end of the last chapter, Holmes is an excellent housekeeper and he can host a great dinner party. I love the opening of chapter 10. Our meal was a merry one. Holmes could talk exceedingly well when he chose, and that night he did choose. He appeared to be in a state of nervous exaltation. I have never known him so brilliant. He spoke on a quick succession of subjects, on miracle plays, on medieval pottery, on Stradivarius violins, on the Buddhism of Ceylon, and on the warships of the future, handling each as though he had made a special study of it. Now I'm going to pause there. Does that sound like an awesome lecture to you guys?
Well, it does, but it also is breaking character in many ways. Was it the first book where Watson and Holmes are talking, and Watson has noticed that Holmes has very deep knowledge on certain areas, but very shallow knowledge on a lot of other things.
Exactly.
And this seems a very broad knowledge right here.
Not really, though. It's all aesthetics, right?
I love how Chip thinks this would have been a great conversation.
I think it sounds...
What?
I was thinking that people might have thought it was a bit of a weird conversation, but I like your enthusiasm for these topics.
I'm all there.
Pretty random, Chip. I don't know if you've had conversations before, but that seems like a pretty random list, my friend.
Well, somebody can run into me, and we can go on a meandering walk of conversations at that point. And maybe we'll go through Stradivarius violins and Buddhism.
Maybe you are the Sherlock of this conversation.
Don't forget the warships of the future, my friend. Anyway,
that would be a Star Trek reference for you, Steve.
I was getting the Buddhism reference. I was okay with that, at least.
But Watson loves it, right? Watson is totally fascinated. He goes on to say, his bright humor marked the reaction from his black depression of the preceding days. Athelney Jones proved to be a sociable soul in his hours of relaxation and faced his dinner with the air of a bon vivant. For myself, I felt elated at the thought that we were nearing the end of our task, and I caught something of Holmes's gaiety. None of us alluded during dinner to the cause which had brought us together. So the three of them all have an awesome time. They put their work aside, and they just concentrate on these really fascinating topics, like the Stradivarius violin and the miracle plays.
And medieval pottery.
Well, you know, the fun part is, as we know more about this chapter, is they have a nice dinner where they have great talk, only to be able to go on this race to solve this mystery.
This is an action-adventure movie, isn't it? This is still on that line with the Indiana Jones films. There's lovely meals in the Indiana Jones films.
There's even a short run in this one, Steve.
There is. This is such an action adventure chapter of this action adventure / romance story. It starts out once again with Holmes asking Watson if he has a pistol, and Watson replies, I have my old service revolver in my desk, and Sherlock says, you had best take it then. It is well to be prepared. He's ready for action here.
And that becomes a trope throughout the stories. How many times have we had that conversation, right?
Well, this is the third time in this book.
Right? That's true. Except Watson didn't bring his revolver.
I've got a stick.
Now he's convinced he needs it.
Right.
And he's right.
Holmes figured out where the boat was, not by going up and down the river, not by using all of the kids to look for it, but instead by plunging into chemical analysis.
Of course, Steve. Hydrocarbons.
Well, I like how he says it. So, well, I gave my mind a thorough rest by plunging into a chemical analysis. One of our greatest statesmen, and my footnote, helpfully pointed out that was William Ewart Gladstone, four-time Prime Minister of Great Britain. One of our greatest statesmen had said that a change of work is the best rest. So it is. When I had succeeded in dissolving the hydrocarbon which I was at work at, I came back to our problem of the Sholtos and thought the whole matter out again. Now, it strikes me that another very good strategy would have been to sleep on it. And I don't know if you guys have read Matthew Walker's really good book, Why We Sleep. I think we've talked about it.
No, Professor. It's another book that we'll put on our list, though. Thanks. Happy Canada Day.
Well, I in fact, I read something or I listened to something. I think every culture has something where it says to sleep on it.
Yeah.
Except for France, they use a different term on, but it roughly means the same thing.
Interesting. But either way, remember that like Holmes has been up for many days now. He has not been sleeping. He's pacing all night, whatever. But you know, there would be
coming down on cocaine too. Just so
exactly, that is true. But there would be some evidence. A little REM sleep might give him a hand.
This is so Doctor Who. This is exactly what the Doctor does. He does not sleep on it. He absolutely goes to some other ridiculous thing to get his mind off of something, to look at the problem sideways. There's so many times where you can solve a problem by not staring directly at it, and that's what Holmes is trying to do here.
And my brain goes away many days, and I had to look up what hydrocarbons are. So I went to possibly the greatest university in the history of this world, the University of Connecticut, and I read a little bit about that. That's right. The Huskies tell me that hydrocarbons are chemicals. That's right. Gasoline, kerosene, lamp oil, furniture oil, those are all examples of hydrocarbons for our listeners who may not have that.
So this experiment must have smelled wonderful.
after a meal of oysters.
Mrs. Hudson would approve. Now, it's interesting as we move through this chapter that as Holmes discusses his own way of looking through things, he says, I knew this man Small had a certain degree of low cunning, but I did not think him capable of anything in the nature of delicate finesse. That is usually a product of higher education. And I kind of paused there because I feel like because Holmes's own education is so sporadic, right, as Watson carefully laid out for us in A Study in Scarlet, I thought, that's a bit unexpected. But then I kind of remembered that throughout this novel, we've had all these quotations in foreign languages that remind us that Holmes, like Watson, is a very well-educated Victorian gentleman. I don't know. What did you guys pause at this point?
I think I'm going to use that, but if I had to read it, I would read it as Thurston Howell III. I think that's a much better way to read that statement there.
You're saying that it's kind of snooty of him?
Oh, it sounds like a little
say
bit.
That this is, he's smart, but he's not educated. And I think this might be Doyle projecting onto the readership a little bit. I wonder, you know, he is writing for the masses. This is a story that is written not for the well-educated, but promoting the idea of education.
In an affordable publication. That's right.
For the every family, for the every person. And you're right, from the person who's not very educated to the very educated. So yeah, he certainly has a broad audience here.
Yeah. And then Holmes does a move that Poe talks about in the Dupin stories from over 40 years earlier. And he says, I then put myself in the place of Small and looked at it as a man of his capacity would. And Poe does it as a chess match, right? So you have to, when you're a detective, you have to be able to see what the criminal's move will be, what your move will be, what their moves will be out. And it seems like that's exactly what he's doing here. Always a matter of perspective.
Aha, there's that word again.
Abby.
Yes.
Something I've been told I don't have a lot of, so.
Tell us about hydrocarbons again. Holmes and Watson get a little philosophical here, thinking about this whole case and how it might fit into the big scheme of things.
And I think this kind of connects back to that question of class and education, because they're sitting in the police boat and they're waiting for the Aurora to come out of the shop where it's been. And they see a bunch of dock workers swarming towards the dock. And this is Holmes. He says, "Dirty looking rascals, but I suppose everyone has some little immortal spark concealed about him. You would not think it to look at them. There is no a priori probability about it. A strange enigma is man." "Someone calls him a soul concealed in an animal," I suggested. "Winwood Reed is good upon the subject," said Holmes. "He remarks that while the individual man is an insoluble puzzle, in the aggregate, he becomes a mathematical certainty." Now, you guys remember Winwood Reed, right?
Mm-hmm. Because you mentioned it in chapter two.
I had never heard of Winwood Reed either. Remember that when I looked it up, it was like, everyone who studies the Victorian period will know this very fine book, The Martyrdom of Man. And I was like, oops, I've never even heard of it. So yes, this is the atheist book that provides the universal history dealing with war, religion, liberty, and intellect. And it's deeply informed by Darwin. So definitely something that I should have read given my areas of specialization. But anyway, certainly something Holmes and Watson. Remember, Watson held the book in his hand, but he didn't open it because he was daydreaming about Mary.
He had it upside down and was a Photoshop.
Exactly, probably.
So I just want to say, Steve Martin said you learned just enough philosophy to screw you up for the rest of your life. It seems like Doyle has taken Winward to task here.
Of course, I take my philosophy from pop culture. So my favorite quote is, "A person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it." That's Agent K from Men in Black.
Of course it is.
Very apropos. I like that.
Apropos, that's for sure.
All right. Not a priori. If we're
Oh, this is getting too intellectual.
Let's get back to the action adventure. Fine.
We need back on an adventure. Now, I love that John reminds us that he's a bit of an adventure hero. This kind of feels like an echo of in the first chapter when he says, "I have known women in three continents," right?
Well.
Here's where he says, "I have coursed many creatures in many countries during my checkered career, but never did sport give me such a wild thrill as this mad flying manhunt down the Thames."
Here we go. This is a boat chase, a full-on action-adventure movie boat chase with all of the tropes.
Can we have loud rock music as we go through?
This is absolutely loud rock music, and there should have been a fruit cart to run into.
Well, there's that tugboat, right, with the three barges in tow.
The quote is, "It blunders between Aurora and the police boat." You could so see this car chase scene on boats. This is Indiana Jones, 100%.
And the sailors are feeding the coal furnace, and Holmes is like, faster. He doesn't have like a shovel or anything, but he's like,
lots of close-ups with shock, you know.
Oh my gosh, totally. And
people jumping off of boats, you never know.
Sherlock is the most emotional that we've seen him. He is shouting at these men, faster, to make this happen, because he's in this chase.
Yeah. And then finally, they get close enough to see Jonathan Small and the little Aboriginal man with the poisonous darts on the back of the Aurora. "Fire if he raises his hand," said Holmes quietly. We were within a boat's length by this time and almost within touch of our quarry. I can see the two of them as they stood, the white man with his legs far apart, shrieking out curses, and the unhallowed dwarf with his hideous face and his strong yellow teeth gnashing at us in the light of our lantern. It was well that we had so clear a view of him. Even as we looked, he plucked out from under his covering a short round piece of wood like a school ruler and clapped it to his lips. Our pistols rang out together. He whirled round, threw up his arms, and with a kind of choking cough, sideways into the stream.
Okay. Now let's think about this really. You're on a very fast boat. You're chasing a very fast boat. Water is usually, you know, not. It's rocky. It's a very rocky moment, and you're going to shoot, and you're going to hit your target. That is an incredible
both
shot.
Both of them, perhaps.
That certainly says that's pretty amazing right there. Let's just say that sounds almost unbelievable. Maybe that's not really how it happened. Maybe that's how Watson wrote that it happened.
Okay, that's valid. But this is in the height of this action. This fits perfectly. Like, these are our superheroes. Those are the villains. This is good and evil perfectly laid out.
And later on, we're going to learn that the shot that guy, I guess, the dart. Yeah, it was equally like on target too. It was crazy. Everybody is super, super competent in this story.
That's right. Now, the capture of Jonathan Small, though, is pretty outlandish, right? I feel like the Aboriginal guy is given, you know, he like falls into the water. We don't know what exactly has happened to him, but Jonathan Small, the fugitive sprang out, but his stump instantly sank its whole length into the sodden soil. In vain, he struggled and writhed. Not one step could he possibly take, either forward or backward. He yelled in impotent rage and kicked frantically into the mud with his other foot, but his struggles only bored his wooden pin the deeper into the sticky bank. When we brought our launch alongside, he was so firmly anchored that it was only by throwing the end of a rope over his shoulders that we were able to haul him out and to drag him like some evil fish over our side.
So Jonathan Small is played by Curly at this point, right, Steve?
I'm stuck.
You got me.
You got me, come on. This is silly. This is such a wonderful action adventure movie that ends on such a low, simple solution like sticky mud.
And the humor here isn't something we've seen before, right? Like, he's an evil fish, and it's like he's caught, like trapped, like a fish in a net. Eventually, there's a literal rope trapping him. So it's a very interesting.
Doyle and your zoomorphism.
And we will, don't forget that Sherlock, you know, negotiated for not only a fast boat, some burly police officers, access to the treasure, first interview with Jonathan Small, and a dinner party with Athelney. So don't forget, we're going to get to see the treasure, and we're going to get first crack at this Jonathan Small evil fish character. Coming up still.
That's right. We got two chapters to go.
But we've got the treasure. They do have the treasure on the boat. They do seize the treasure. It's locked, so we don't get to see it in this chapter, but theoretically next chapter they will open it and see the product of all of this action adventure.
And now, guys, am I wrong? I don't think we had a single mention of Mary in this whole chapter.
Nope. Well, they left her at home. They told her.
Compartmentalization. Right.
she only shows up only to be dismissed. You know, just like Watson was that one chapter when he played Mary.
Yeah, this is definitely not the romance chapter. This is very good.
It's very compartmentalized.
Very compartmentalized, but a really good structure for an action adventure movie. This is Indiana Jones. The girl is certainly at the center of the mystery, but she's not in this scene. This is the boat chase scene.
Right. Which brings us to the ending of the chapter. As we steamed slowly upstream again, we flashed our searchlight in every direction. But there was no sign of the islander. Somewhere in the dark ooze at the bottom of the Thames lie the bones of that strange visitor to our shores. "See here," said Holmes, pointing to the wooden hatchway. "We were hardly quick enough with our pistols." There, sure enough, just behind where we had been standing, stuck one of those murderous darts which we knew so well. It must have whizzed between us at the instant that we fired. Holmes smiled at it and shrugged his shoulders in his easy fashion, but I confess that it turned me sick to think of the horrible death which had passed so close to us that night. End of chapter. So, a couple things here. Do you guys think the islander is really dead? I mean, they look around, but they can't find his body. Is he stuck in the ooze of the bottom of the river?
Well, I've seen enough movies to know that there's a sequel if there's enough interest.
if there's a missing body of a bad guy, right?
But we've read enough Sherlock Holmes at this point that I do believe Doyle when he presents this as truth. I don't see Doyle giving us a twist like that because he's never done it before.
It's true. It's
he doesn't have a modern agent, Steve.
Well,
a modern agent. That's right. They left it for a part two. Not at that day. Not at that time when this was written. But certainly today. You know, we would eventually would find out that little guy is actually the ringleader of all of it.
And there it is. There's the trope that we have discussed several times before, is the twist would be the opposite of what Doyle does. Doyle doesn't do those sorts of things. Maybe he will this time. Maybe this is the one time that he's going to switch up the trope on us. But my money's on no. He's going to deliver the straightforward truth. This is what happened. This is how it's going to go down. And then it's up to everybody adapting these ideas, these concepts later, where those twists will come in.
He's setting the trope.
That's right. Yeah. Toby will come back later on.
We can only hope. What do we learn about Holmes and about Watson in their very opposite reactions to near death?
Well, life is but an adventure for Mr. Holmes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that easy fashion, right?
His deep smile and shrug was like, yep, this is the most fun I've had all week.
Pretty soon, he's picking up the princess and he's swinging across, you know, to safety from the stormtroopers. You never know, Steve.
There was definitely a stormtrooper type moment here, but all of the shots hit. That was the difference.
What about Watson, who almost turned sick at the thought of dying here?
Well, that seems like a very human reaction. I mean, we see it in military situations, firefighters, police officers. If you go through something that is incredibly traumatic like that, you know, it's not always like you've got this adrenaline rush, but you're also, once you come down from that, you could get sick. Your body is not designed to deal with those types of traumas or potential death situations all the time.
But Watson was in the war. He's already stared down the face of death. This is his realization that sometimes the situations outside of war are worse than situations in war. This is something that we've already talked about.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it easy. I mean, the person who goes through war situation, or I don't know, just make it easier, saves a person in a burning house, the next time that doesn't make it easier. It's just you're touching death.
Mm-hmm. So, ask, do you guys think that Watson is changed by his recent love for Mary?
Oh, I think he has something to live for. I think he has a future in front of him that he is thinking about in this situation.
Because that's kind of how I read this, that I feel like Watson, before the opening of this book, might have been, and you know, he reminds us here that he's, like, in this novel, he reminds us that he's known women in three continents and that he's been on a million adventures before. But now, he doesn't say, I always feel sick when I come close to death. He says, I confess that it turned me sick. You think of the horrible death, which had come so close. I mean, to me, that feels like a transformative moment for him. Like, Watson is now an adult in an adult relationship.
So John Williams is going to take the love theme and he's going to start out light and just, you know, it's going to come up. It's going to be a full theme at that point.
And then we'll have
his heart is opening, like a lotus flower opening, Steve.
Oh, boy.
So we'll have some sort of image of Mary in his head here because Mary's, you know, just not there.
I might be overreading that too, guys, and please stop me if you think I am, but because Mary isn't mentioned in this entire chapter, but I kind of wondered about this final
day. On Canada Day? I'm not stopping you. You go. Is there any maple syrup in the house?
There isn't my house.
Of course. Of course, Dave.
This is wonderful. This is great. I'm not a big action movie fan, but I like the vision of this action movie that Doyle is writing in this chapter. I wonder what's going to happen in chapter 11. We have the treasure. Theoretically, we're going to go back to Mary and have Mary open it and see what this treasure was. We'll find out tomorrow when we get to chapter 11. Hope you're all listening along, enjoying this as much as we are, and having your own action adventures on Canada Day.
In the pandemic, but not too many actions or adventures. Stay safe.
Very few actions. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Send us an email. Send us your pictures. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of the information from around the world. And go to our dedicated website, Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, for the list of all these conversations. This is episode 91 of the Pam and the Two Schmucks show. So I hope you're all enjoying your Canada Day. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Action Adventure Chip Essenclaw.
And I'm Canadian. And I'm Canadian, Pam Bedore.
I'm just going to edit out the Pam Bedore, and I'm Canadian.